Natalie Haynes is a writer and broadcaster and, according to the Washington Post, a rock star mythologist. She's been longlisted and shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction and is the author of The Amber Fury, The Children of Jocasta, A Thousand Ships and Stone Blind. A passionate voice on the classical world, Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics is her popular series on BBC Radio 4. Her new novel, No Friend to This House, takes the story of Medea and retells it in a new and illuminating way. And Natalie Haynes joins me on the line this evening. Welcome to Arena.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You've written novels before that turn on famous myths. What was it about this particular story that made you think that there might be a novel in it?
Well, I have loved the Euripides play Medea since I was a child. It's the first Greek play I saw in Greek. I saw Diana Rigg play Medea when I was still at school. My dad drove me from Birmingham, where I grew up, to London to see her perform. It's the first or maybe second Greek play I read in Greek during my A-levels. It got me straight away. I wrote a paper on her at university. I wrote my dissertation on infanticide. I don't have children before people write in. I didn't used to have them either, just to be clear. Make that certain. I've probably seen the play 20 or 30 times in my life, in languages from, English to Dutch to Japanese, most recently this year. I'd loved it for so long. Like, I kind of thought, I don't have anything to add to it. And then as time's gone on, I've thought, but it's just one day. It's just one day in her life in the play. And I would like to write a sort of more grand scale version of her story. I'd like to write a kind of a bigger beginning and middle and end that's not just all focused on this one desperate, awful day, but on her whole story. So it was just the most tempting thing. But I still sat down and translated the play longhand into a notebook before I started writing this book, because I felt I couldn't start the novel until I'd done that.
That's proper devotion to the job.
I am such a nerd, aren't I? It's like, it's adorable that I think that is work avoidance. Oh, I think I'll just sit here and translate an ancient Greek play.
But before we get into the nuts and bolts of this, then maybe explain to us a little bit of what you have done in the book itself.
So what I wanted to do was tell the story of the Argo, essentially, the quest for the Golden Fleece. And this dates right back to, it's mentioned in Homer's Odyssey when Circe tells Odysseus to be careful which route he takes, that he can't go through the wandering rocks, because only Jason and the Argo made it through there and the goddess Hera was helping them. And then, there's a much more detailed version of the story in Pindar's Fourth Pythian Ode from the mid-5th century, from 461, 462 BCE. Apollonius of Rhodes, a Hellenistic writer in Alexandria, produced the Argonautica, which is a relatively short four-book epic poem. And they all these different versions of the story kind of focused on different bits of the quest of various heroes of Greece. This is the generation before the Trojan War, so they are still the sons and of gods, and they are demigods like Heracles. Orpheus, son of Apollo, is there, Castor and Polydeuces. And they go off on this gigantically, important quest in this beautiful ship, the Argo, to try and find the Golden Fleece, which is the perfect MacGuffin, because like all traditional MacGuffins in cinema since, everybody wants it. And then when they've got it, it doesn't really matter. It's just the act of getting it is what counts. But in order to get it, Jason gets involved romantically and sexually with the princess of Colchis, where the fleece is held. So modern day Georgia. So they have to sail all the way from Greece to Georgia and row all the way from Greece to Georgia. And they go on to have a family, and then things melt down.
The story is told in a way, as so many have been in recent times, and it's utterly fascinating. So there's stories and characters that have always been there, but just the focus has never really been on those characters themselves.
Well, I mean, Euripides' Medea is probably his best-known play today, I would say. It's certainly the most performed of his plays today. So actually, I think this one is an unusual Greek myth insofar as, by modern standards, I think Medea is probably as well-known as Jason. I mean, maybe not for my generation growing up watching the Ray Harryhausen Jason and the Argonauts every bank holiday. That focuses on Jason and Medea, and he has a tiny role in it. I think because according to interviews I read later, they didn't get on, the two actors, which seems incredibly appropriate. But these things happen, etc. But yeah, in terms of our ancient sources, Medea, it takes a lot of I mean, in Hesiod, for example, he cites Jason as being one of the sort of small number of mortal men who enter into a relationship with a goddess. So for him, you know, Medea is clearly both divine and frankly a bit more important than Jason.
I'm thinking a little bit about the way you describe, so Cleite, if I have that right, because I've only ever seen it written down and never heard it said out loud.
She's from Apollonius of Rhodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's only known as Cleite with the exquisite hair in most of the versions of the story.
Cleite with the beautiful hair, that's right, yeah. And so when I find things like this, you know, Greek has these sort of epithets. Homer is obviously full of Homeric epithets, as they are known. And usually they're there for the meter of the poem. And so Clytie becomes Clytie with the beautiful hair, so that the poem scans more easily. And it just seemed to me that if you were an actual normal human person, and the only thing that people ever described about you was what your hair looked like, unless you were a hair model, that would get a little irritating. Mm-hmm. So it was just a joy to give her something else to say. And she's incensed that people always miss her out. And that they just sort of overlook her, and the only thing that's interesting to them about her is, you know, her beauty, and that was of transitory. So I wanted to give her a voice. You're right, there are lots of women in this story. Hypsipyle was a much better known character in antiquity than she is today. You know, Euripides wrote a lost play about her, for example. But their stories have been forgotten, and that's just because we've lost the vast majority of ancient literature. You know, between 97% and 99% of ancient Greek literature doesn't survive to us today. So there's a lot of space if you're someone like me who's a tremendous nerd and loves digging down into ancient Greek, that there's always going to be someone that people will be fascinated by, I'm certain, but that they probably don't yet know.
Yep. Theophanes' story in this, though, is so sad, because when we think of the golden fleece, you think of a sheep's coat, you think of something inert, but it wasn't the case at all.
Well, I know I sound incredibly naive saying this, so I'm just going to keep going through the sentence, and you'll have to, you know, just stop me at the point where everyone will mock me in the street. But I really like sheep. I've been vegetarian for 37 years. So generally in my books, animals tend not to, I mean, animals get sacrificed in ancient Greek religion, so you can't avoid it, but it's never been a sheep. You go through all my books and sheep are always completely unharmed.
Good to know.
And I tried so hard with the golden fleece. I was like, but what if it's a fleece and you just sort of shave it off a sheep with whatever, you know, Bronze Age tool is available to you? And that would be great, but it's not. It's derma is the word in Greek in some of our sources, for example, sheepskin. And I'm like, oh. So yeah, I did have to kill a sheep this time. In fact, technically I killed two, but only in fiction. I would never do it in real life. And so, yeah, one of the great kind of pains of this book, it seemed to me, was the way people lost their children. It's a myth which is incredibly, even by the standards of ancient myth, it's really populated with children who are in terrible danger. They won't make it to adulthood because of their own parents or because of someone else's parent, because a parent doesn't care about them, or because a parent, you know, weaponizes them. And they're always imperiled. And one of those children was Chrysomelos, the golden ram. And I thought, well, if you just think of him as the sort of source of the golden fleece, then he just becomes a kind of, he doesn't really exist as a creature. He's just an object in the waiting. We're just waiting for him to turn into the thing we want. And I thought, but the fact that we've got sources which tell us who his parents are, that Poseidon, the god, is his father, and that his mother is a young woman named Theophany, I was like, well, how just out of interest is she going to feel about this? And once you've had those thoughts, you know, it becomes very easy to imagine somebody who does not at all see their child as just an animal, or doesn't at all see their child as an object in waiting, but is desperately heartbroken that other people do. And so Theophany was, I think you can hear that when I read her in the audiobook, I'm genuinely very upset. So yeah, no, it is quite a difficult bit of the book, but she seems to be resonating with people. But with the early readers anyway.
I haven't even gotten as far as Medea yet. I mean, people are familiar with the myth, or perhaps familiar with the play. They'll have seen versions of it. Can you talk to us just a little bit about what is different about the Medea that we find in your novel to the Medea that we might already know?
Well, she owes a little bit to Pindar's version of Medea, who is a
has a profound connection with the divine. She can deliver oracles. You know, the men of the Argo will sit in silence listening to her. Spoiler, that doesn't often happen in the ancient world. And then Apollonius of Rhodes, when he takes on the story in his Argonautica, is very keen to emphasize two things about her, really, which almost seem to be at odds with one another. The first is that she's supremely powerful. She's a very powerful witch or sorceress, if you prefer. She has incredible magical skill. She's very knowledgeable, and she's a priestess to Hecate, who is the goddess of witches. So she is extremely well-connected, extremely and extremely knowledgeable, exactly who you should go to if you are a wandering adventurer, Jason, who is hoping to complete some impossible tasks in order to try and win the Golden Fleece. She is the person who can protect you from, you know, fire-breathing creatures and things like that. But at the same time, a young woman, and she's more than capable of falling deeply in love with a handsome wandering adventurer like Jason. And she does. And then, you know, both of those aspects of her, powerful witch, teenage girl, seem to be slightly at odds with the version of her that we meet at the beginning of the Euripides play, where she's devastated. Jason has, they've been married, they've had children, and he's just walked out on her in order to marry somebody else, somebody better connected and more Greek, Medea being, as the Greeks perceive her, Barian or Colchian. In a more neutral way. And it's like, well, where did all that power go? Where did all the romance go? Okay, maybe that's just the reality of marriage, but where did the power go? And so in my novel, I try to answer that question and build a sort of composite of all these different aspects of Medea that would seem like a true psychological portrait.
Yeah, now that we've talked around and about Jason, he doesn't come out of this story very well, does he? Or at least not perhaps the brave character that people might have in their minds if all they've seen is the Ray Harryhausen.
Exactly, because he is much braver in Ray Harryhausen than he is in our ancient sources, truthfully. You know, the earliest narrative that we have about him in Pindar says that he's very heroic because he's really good with language. He's great with words. So he's not like Hercules, if you prefer his Roman name, who comes into a room and, you know, arm wrestles a lion into submission. He's persuasive. He talks you into things. That's what's heroic about Jason. But in Apollonius's version of him, he's also quite uncertain of himself. And he sometimes weaponizes that uncertainty against the other Argonauts, because there's a counter tradition that we don't spend too much time thinking of now, but nonetheless existed in antiquity, where the Argonauts preferred Heracles to be their captain, which you can well understand. You know, he's the son of Zeus, so he's really well connected. And he's, you know, already this hyper-masculine ideal. You know, he can do all these incredible labors without any kind of breaking of a sweat, practically. So you'd probably choose him for the captain. But in Apollonius, he says, oh, no, it's, you know, Jason's the one who's fated to do this. And the Argonauts are still very uncertain about him. And when they stop and they're not behaving in a way that Heracles wants them to, he basically foments a sort of uprising against Jason until they do what he wants. So Jason is never the sort of powerful figure that we might expect, that we see in Achilles in the Iliad, for example, or, as I say, in Heracles in his stories. He's always quite a sort of caveated hero. You know, he gets a lot of help from women, from Hypsipyle, from Medea. He gets a lot of help from goddesses, Hera, Aphrodite, and Athene. And so without those constant sources of help and support, and sometimes simply doing it for him, then it's hard to know how successful he would have been. There is an extraordinary vase painting called the Doris Cup that's now held in the Vatican museums, in the Etruscan Museum at the Vatican in Rome. And that shows a version of this story that we just have forgotten, whichever version it is. But it's basically the fleece is hanging in a tree. And Jason, he's labeled, so it's definitely him, has been swallowed or is in the process of being swallowed by a giant snake. And he looks incredibly dead. He's sort of hanging out of the snake's mouth, and his arms are limp and his hair is limp, hanging. And he looks incredibly dead. But, you know, so is this a version of the story where he gets swallowed by the snake and fights his way out? That's something Heracles does with a sea monster in one of his stories. Or is this what it looks like to me, which is a version of the story where Jason doesn't survive the encounter with the guardian of the fleece? Either way, not versions of the story we know, and they're a little bit more kind of critical of Jason's heroic nature, let's say.
I'm interested, given that it's such a huge part of your work, what is it you think that keeps Greek myth so fascinating after all this time?
I think the point about Greek myth, which is so engrossing to us, is that the unit of currency is a human life. And especially in Greek tragedy, which is, you know, with almost no exceptions, which is based on Greek myth, the unit of currency is a human life. So everything costs something to somebody. It doesn't operate at a grand scale that doesn't touch us. You know, there isn't a gigantic snake devouring its own tail. There isn't a giant tree that the world is. The gods behave in very human adjacent ways. They are very different from us because obviously they are immortal, so they don't really change and they're never going to die, although they can still be injured. Aphrodite gets injured in book 5 of the Iliad. But human beings are so central to it. And when we see what even the most kind of extraordinary circumstances, like the story of Oedipus, I suppose, you know, most of us, I assume, have very little experience of killing our fathers and marrying our mothers. But the idea that you might suddenly find out you had done something terrible unwittingly, we really know what that is. We have every sense of that, I think. I think one of the reasons that Medea, Euripides' Medea, is performed so frequently is because, depressing as it is, we all know a couple whose acrimonious breakup has involved weaponizing their children against one another. And it looks incredibly familiar. So that human cost, that human centering, I think, you know, essentially we're quite self-absorbed as a species. We like to see ourselves reflected in stories, and Greek myth provides that to the max. It shows a sort of extreme version. What would it be like if you were a super powerful person, but then you had these terrible obstacles to overcome? What would it be like if you were not a super powerful person, but had some power, and then this awful thing befell you? We can imagine what we would do in the same circumstances. So I think it's an endlessly fascinating reflective surface to us. But imagine that the reflectors are all tiny, like bits of a kaleidoscope. So we're always seeing just a tiny different aspect of ourselves and those around us. And that, I think, is why Greek myth is so compelling to us still.
Do you have any thoughts as to why there have been so many impressive retellings, both of myths and of historical stories in recent times in lots of different formats, just foregrounding frequently lost women in those stories?
I think the tremendous news for classicists like me is that women weren't included in those stories for a couple of hundred years. They were included in antiquity. 7 of the 8 tragedies that Euripides wrote about the Trojan War have women as the title characters. But then in classicism or neoclassicism, the 1800s and 1900s particularly, it was a preserve of posh white men, posh white British men or German men, actually. There were lots of German classicists too. I don't think it was malevolent. I don't think they were ignoring women or missing them out on purpose. I just don't think it occurred to them that women's stories needed to be told. They were more impressed by the Iliad and its tales of heroism on the battlefield than they were by the Odyssey, which has lots more complicated, more interesting women in it. Mm-hmm. They were more impressed by either of those epic poems than they were by Greek tragedies. And when they like Greek tragedies, they tended to like the ones with more men in. So you can see how it happened. But all these characters, you know, Ovid wrote an incredible set of poems called the Heroides, which imagined the perspective of ancient heroines. And that was more than 2,000 years ago. So it's always been the case that writers who have been willing to look a bit beyond their own experience could find extraordinary characters to represent in telling retellings of myth. But just for a long time, classics was the preserve of rich men who didn't think they needed to.
Just before I finish with you, is there a new series of Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics on the way?
Yes, there'll be one. Series 12, impossibly, will happen next year. So we'll probably record it in the spring. It should be on your, I was going to say wireless, showing my age. It should be on radio sometime in the summer, I hope.
It's been fantastic to talk to you tonight, Natalie Haynes. Thanks for joining us on Arena.
Thanks for having me.
The novel is No Friend to This House, and it's out now with Mantle.